ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Well, last time we talked about AI, artificial intelligence, here on the program, an open letter had just been signed by some of the most important tech billionaires and researchers in the world. The letter, released about a year ago, demanded an immediate pause on AI development for 6 months until humanity could get a handle on what's actually being created. Well, that went down well, didn't it? That never happened. Although governments were starting to release discussion papers on the applications of AI and how it should be regulated, so everything will be okay now, won't it? In January, the Australian government released an AI discussion paper acknowledging that AI has improved already many aspects of our lives, developments in healthcare, for example. However, the paper warned that the speed of innovation in AI could pose new risks. So where are we at right now? Here's the ever-prescient comedian and political journalist John Stewart on AI just recently.
Whether it's globalization or industrialization or now artificial intelligence, the way of life that you are accustomed to is no match for the promise of more profits and new markets, which sounds brutal if you're a human. But at least those other disruptions took place over a century or decades. AI is going to be ready to take over by Thursday. And once that happens, what the f*** is there left for the rest of us to do?
Well, it's a good question, isn't it? Thursday is not so far away. Also, just recently, a group of American Congress representatives were asked about whether they knew what AI was.
Do you understand what AI does?
I have an elementary understanding.
I've got a lot to know about what's going on.
Very frankly, it's new terrain and uncharted territory.
Do we have the knowledge set here to do it? No.
The short answer is no. The long answer is hell no.
There we go. Well, joining us tonight, we have two people who do know. Dr. Katrina Wallace is co-author of Checkmate Humanity, the How and Why of Responsible AI, and also a shark on Network 10's Shark Tank Australia. Katrina, good evening to you. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Hey, thanks, Phil.
Lovely to have you with us. Also joining us again, Stephen Sheila is the CEO of the company Omniscient AI, founder of Global Advisory, the digital CEO. He also helped start up Facebook in Australia during the early years of the tech company here. So, Stephen, good evening to you.
Good evening.
And welcome back, too.
Good to be back.
It's all those congressmen saying no, nup. You get the same response here, quite frankly. Because people don't know what it is. I mean, we love talking about it because it's the phrase in the room, but how do we define it? Katrina, tell me what it is.
So I think the most simple way and accessible way, Phil, is that it's a software that can mimic or replicate cognitive functions of a human intelligence. Mm. And so that really is just software that can do a bunch of things that humans' brain can do. And when we really boil it down, we want to really focus on machine learning. And machine learning as a type of AI is a machine that can, or software that can learn by undertaking tasks. And the more tasks it undertakes, the more it learns. So that's the simplest way. There's obviously much more technical ways, but I'd say software that mimics human intelligence.
Mm. Stephen, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a good definition. I would add one other thing. I think another way to think about it is not as AI, but as IA, intelligence augmentation, instead of artificial intelligence, because these are tools that make us better at what we already do. I think that's one of the great applications of AI. It's kind of like, what does a hammer do? A hammer means you can hammer that nail better than you could with your fist, right? Mm. So it's an arm augmenter, right? It's arm augmentation in terms of what a hammer can do or other tools you hold in your hand. Well, AI is sort of a tool you hold with your brain, and it makes your brain better at doing what it already does. And in some cases, it may be able to replace your brain or replace things that you do with your brain today. And that's where the great fear comes, which is if this replaces enough of what we do, what role will humans have, or what role will we have in the roles and the jobs that we do today?
Mm. Let's talk some more about this, about what it actually is, because when we discussed this, and this was even further ago when we first discussed AI on the program, we talked about the debate that had occurred during the 60s, for example, into the 70s about what AI was, and people couldn't agree.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a massive intellectual rift people essentially gave up on it almost because no one could agree on what it actually was.
Well, even defining intelligence in humans is difficult to do. So now we're defining a new type of intelligence. So there is a lot of difficulty there.
So what we seem to have landed on is this large language format form of AI. So this is where, through powerful computing tools, we can look at every single thing that humans have ever uttered about anything on a particular topic and through the use of powerful computers, make a judgment about that material. So it's a kind of a souped-up Google, is it, Stephen?
Yeah, that's one way to think about it. So the latest hype in AI that everyone's talking about, and AI has been around for, as you mentioned, decades, and there's been other applications that have been around for decades, and it's been in many of the products and services we use for a long time. But the recent hype is around this development of large language models, which enables this concept of generative AI, where you can lay apps or bots on top of a large language model to allow a generation of new capability that becomes very human-like, as Katrina alluded to before. And this is the kind of the new realm that we're moving into where, as you say, is it a souped-up Google? In a sense, it is. It's a tool that actually can take your thinking and take it a step further than you could have taken yourself. And it's so human and lifelike or human-like in its intelligence, it's almost magical at this point in time.
It almost seems like that, doesn't it? I was reflecting on this the other day when I was using my Hey Siri function. Actually, I'm about to be careful here. They don't see my phone's gone off already. Okay.
get Siri out of here.
Get a Siri out of here. What Siri does, of course, when you ask Siri a question, is that they give you a range of stuff they found. But it's pretty primitive compared to what, for example, ChatGPT would do for you. Yeah. Because if you said, look, a simple question like, what's the population of India? That's easy for it. But if you said, give me some great Indian recipes, for example, that I could cook tonight, for example, Siri wouldn't do so well in that. They would give you a whole raft of stuff, but you'd have to make decisions yourself. If you ask ChatGPT this, they'll give you one, for example, if you ask them to give you one. So what's been the difference here? Is it computing power? Is it what's enabled this next step to take place?
Right. Well, I think it's really important for us to understand that the generative AI, which is what we're talking about now, which was really still, 70 years in the making, but kind of popped out with OpenAI's announcement in November 22 of one type of generative AI, which was ChatGPT. Now, there are tens of thousands of other types. Based on the use of large language models is only one type of AI. There's plenty of other types of AI, but let's focus on that as the main one. So essentially what those models have been able to do, and again, if we use the parallel of the human brain, it is like a massive 157 billion parameter node brain that is trained on human language in a much more sophisticated way than perhaps Google search is. Although now, of course, we have the generative AI models plugged into the search engine, so they are much more sophisticated than previously. And essentially, what I think people don't quite understand is that it still comes down to mathematics. So what the machines will do is they'll interpret a text, a human language or human voice, human language text, human language voice instruction, turn that into a mathematics, cast it into this huge brain. The brain lights up based on the training that it's had. Mm-hmm. It'll pull together based on a kind of a confidence level that it has the right answer and then provide that back. Now, back to the person who's asked, and it does that in a split second, and then we have, of course, the prompting. So prompting is then asking for more specifics or for it to be done in a different way. So this is very different to traditional search engines. So what is happening is this brain is, based on the algorithms at hand and its training data, pulling together very, very sophisticated information that I think it gets mostly 60% right. And then, of course, it hallucinates terribly, which is, I'm sure, something Stephen and I can dive into. It gets things wrong. It doesn't give reference or credit or accreditation. and there are significant problems with it. But in itself, it is, I regard it as a superpower. You know, we released a superpower into the planet in November 2022 with no controls, no rules, no guidelines, no laws.
What did we release though? It was a computer program? It was a new form of computing? What was it, an NVIDIA chip? What was it?
Yeah, well, it was the generative AI, which are based on large language models. Mm. And this was, it's not new.
The culmination of work.
Look, it's not new to Stephen and I. The AI company I built in 11 years ago had a very tiny version of this. So, you know, we've been seeing this coming for a long time.
So what it was, I mean, for those listeners who don't know, you can get this ChatGPT on your phone. So you simply have to go to Google it, Google OpenAI or ChatGPT. It'll allow you to download the app to your phone or onto your computer. You can get a free version of it or you can get a paid version of it. It costs a few dollars a month. And that is the tool that you can start with to start to ask it questions that and there's other capabilities it has as well. It's called multimodal now, where it can create, you can type in prompts and it'll create an image, it'll create a video for you. There's other competing products that do the same thing. And it can also absorb images and absorb video and actually then turn those into other forms of content as well. And it does it in remarkably fast time. I remember when I first started using ChatGPT, a year and a half ago, it was amazing how fast it would respond. I mean, it was faster than Google, and it would write out the answer in front of you faster than you could possibly.
But how did that happen? Did that happen because NVIDIA developed a better chip?
It's a combination,
or someone wrote a better code, someone wrote a better code.
So we've had a confluence of things over the past 10 years or so that have made this possible. So one is the speed of compute has increased enormously, and the cost has gone down. So
and that's Stephen, since 1956 when AI was first coined to now. 1 trillion times the computing power.
There you go. I mean, and the cost.
Say that again.
One. From when AI was first coined, 1956, to 2024, we have 1 trillion times the computing power.
Yeah, at a millionth of the cost as well. So
can we pause on that for a second?
How many zeros is that in 1 trillion?
Hang on, Katrina. Does that mean in another 30 years we can repeat that? Or can't we? Do we know? How powerful a computer could become?
See, what we also need to look at, which is my job in industry, is to look at what's coming. Hmm. And so, what's coming is quantum computing. So you plug the power of quantum into the power of AI, and at some stage, I'm sure we'll mention the metaverse. This then we level up and we level up very quickly. So Stephen and I will see. Every day, some new big AI development, almost every day, certainly almost every week. So last week, I think it was the Devon by Cognition AI, which is a full software engineer made out of AI that behaves and does things as a human engineer. Extraordinary.
Yeah. We're living in an era now. And this has happened before, but it's really happening at a fast rate now, where we're getting a confluence of different technologies that come together that then create this rapid acceleration. So the reason AI has suddenly exploded is we've had the computing power is cheaper and faster, as Katrina has pointed out, and it hit an inflection point in the past few years. The cloud now emerges where we can store enormous amounts of data at a very low cost, and we can access it quickly through things like wireless and the internet, which now is faster than it's ever been before. And then at the same time, we've got the quantum of data that's been spat out over the past 20 years with the internet. And then finally, you bring together the algorithms, the mathematics, the smart people that have been working on these problems for years. And finally, the smart people have been there a long time, but they haven't had the tools, the speed, the cost was too high, et cetera. Now the cost is cheap enough, the data is ample enough, and the computing power is strong enough to be able to, powerful enough to be able to build these sorts of tools. Mm. And as Katrina mentions, we have other technologies evolving as well, metaversian, immersion, augmented reality type technology. We've got the emergence of quantum computing, which still seems a few years off, but
one's built one yet, have they? I mean,
they have.
Not really.
At a small scale.
At a very small scale. Yeah. No, I mean, well, I've, I'm, Sorry, there's a woman at Sydney University we've interviewed about this who's trying to build one.
Right.
I mean, in a very tiny way, they can prove that you could do this, but no one's actually built one.
Well, it depends what you are talking about. So,
you would know, Katrina.
Well, no. So, like Microsoft offers quantum capabilities in its platform. I think Facebook is talking and got things in the background.
We're not at scaled quantum computing yet.
But
certainly, I guess the point is that some of these technologies are accelerating so fast that they'll be upon us before you know it.
Yeah, exactly.
And quantum's probably
that's
one of those.
The point, I suppose. Yeah, that's right. That it's coming.
It's coming.
Yeah. What do you say? I mean, people. I've talked to people about this, and they say with a resigned, you know, expression on their face that says, "Here we go again." Yeah, but you know, this is what computers always do. They just do stuff with stuff that's there. I mean, they can't think of anything new themselves. And so I try and have a discussion about, yes, but what do you think intelligence is anyway? And that leads to some interesting arguments, doesn't it? But what do you make of this whole idea that all we're doing is mucking around with existing information, not creating new stuff?
I don't think that's
even makes
the case.
Makes any sense.
Well, I think from existing information, new discoveries can be made. So we had the great example of, I think again it was Microsoft who were running. They were looking for a new type of lithium battery construction, and what would have taken them years and years and years, done a traditional way of researching and testing prototypes, they did in 3 weeks and came up with a brand new type of battery. So is that using existing information to invent something new? Probably. I think so. So I think it's... I do think it can be generating... Well, absolutely it can be generating ideas, inventions that humans would not be able to do with existing tools on their own.
And in addition, taking some of the grunt work off of humans that we waste time on, frankly, that could actually be done by assistants. It's kind of, you go back to the, I didn't live through this era, but you know, before the combustion engine was invented, before steam power was invented, when everything was animal power. That's why we use horsepower as a term for cars, right? Literally, horses were how we measured power. And then electrification came, the combustion engine came, and what changed? Humans didn't have to pull things around anymore. Animals didn't have to haul things around anymore. We replaced it with machines. And we're going through the same thing now with AI. And computers have done this to an extent over the past 20, 30 years, but if you really look at the data, you'll see that economic productivity has really not improved at all since the invention of the internet. It really hasn't shifted. So computers and the internet haven't changed productivity, but AI is likely to be quite different. It is probably going to change how productive we are, and it's going to change the nature of the work we do. So when we look back 20, 30, 40, 100 years from now, I think it's the same as looking back 150 years into the 19th century. We're going to be saying, well, I can't believe that people actually hauled those coal trucks out of the mine, you know, why didn't we have machines to do it? We'll have AI doing things for us that we'll consider menial labor. And I mean, I'll give an example of myself. I mean, I've spent my whole career in business and you know, how many PowerPoint slides have I produced, right? Over that period of time, Katrina might be the same.
Thousands
and thousands and thousands.
More than thousands.
And just sitting there formatting and moving these around and changing fonts and putting your ideas down. And the fact that now I can start to create those tools, it's still a little primitive, but the promise is there. Very soon I can create things without having to, you know, faff around with PowerPoint in the way that I used to. To me, is liberating. Now I can take my ideas, I can get them into some sort of expression that I can share them with someone else, and it doesn't take me all that hard work that I used to have to do. So I'm excited by many of those tools just in my everyday life.
Plus, we'll be able to generate video. I mean, this is a great story about Tyler Perry, the Hollywood film mogul who was spending $800 million in building a film studio, and then he was shown the demonstration of Sora,
and then
S-O-R-A.
He stopped.
And so Sora is OpenAI's video and film creation software based on generative AI. So Tyler Perry just saw the demonstration. We've all seen it. And demonstrations like you type in golden retriever puppies playing in the snow, and then Sora will produce a photorealistic short 1 minute film on golden retrievers playing in the snow that looks very, very real. So then Tyler Perry put all his film production plans on hold because he knew we could not compete with Sora.
This was going to be the future.
This will be the
future. I know, I've seen it myself. I've seen an example because, you know, I like motorcycles. I said motorcycles, a motorcyclist going through a curving mountain trail with snow.
I've seen that one.
You know?
Yeah, it's stunning.
It's amazing.
Beautiful. Yeah.
And it's just created out of nothing. Mm-hmm. And, but no one stood with the camera anywhere.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that movies will stop getting made or Netflix series will stop getting made. What it does mean, it will change the economics of how those series gets made, which could be good for as well, which means people with smaller checkbooks who are still creative. I mean, how many creative people in the world can't get a film made or can't get a series made because they can't get financing or funding? Sure. Well, now they may be able to make this stuff on their own with a much smaller budget. We might get a burst of creativity, an explosion of creativity, because we still need storytelling. We still need human stories. I think there's still going to be a major role for humans to play. But just the where the money is going, the cost is going, can be reduced substantially by AI replacing some of those tools. Now, if I'm the script writer or if I'm the the production engineer or I'm the graphics person, of course, I'm going to be worried about my job. Mm. But long term, this may transform that industry in a way that we can't even anticipate today.
The lesson, we've discussed this before in the program, I must say, that the lesson of all big technological changes is that they weren't job destroying. The lesson is almost, they did destroy a lot of existing jobs, but they also created a lot of new ones.
And they tended to be...
And they did not result in mass unemployment.
But they tended to be slower burns.
This is different. Katrina, I know, this is what I want to ask you. This feels different, doesn't it?
It is different. And if we follow the World Economic Forum, they predict that within the next, it's probably 12 months now, there'll be 85 million jobs directly replaced by AI, but 92 million jobs directly created by AI. 90% of that 85 million jobs will be the jobs of women, minorities and youth because they're the entry-level jobs. So that's a concerning thing. And it's the first time that we AI leaders have started to talk about the serious need for a basic universal income to be associated with the potential scale of job loss associated with AI.
Yeah. Here's another disturbing thought. Who owns it anyway, though, Stephen? Because it's a creation, as we've discussed, and it's a creation and a combination of technology, i.e., very powerful computing and code writing. It's a creation, but it's not a creation that's available to everybody. It's owned by people, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a very good. This is something I've actually been talking about for a few years now. All the AI in the world that we use and that we use every day, it belongs to somebody else. Google owns it, or OpenAI owns it, or Meta owns it, or the ATO owns it. They're using AI to check out your tax return and make sure you're paying enough taxes. So somebody else owns it. But the question is, where's the AI that works for me, right? That I control, that I own. And that tool doesn't really exist today. I actually think that's an opportunity in the next few years for smart businesses to start to build and create that tool so that, you have AI by your side that's working for you, not working for anybody else, has your best interests at heart, it protects your data, protects your
be AI tools that you could have yourself on your own computer.
So I built one a couple of years ago. So because I do a lot of public speaking talking about AI, I thought, well, I kind of give the same talk over and over again and answer the same questions over and over again. I can probably get a robot built that can do my talks instead of me. So I did. I got one of my engineers and we built a robot called Trinity. And then I trained it on all my talks and then we trained it on question and answer.
This is a fascinating story and I want to continue it, but we've just got to bring in some other listeners here, would you, just to build our truly national audience here.
This is Nightlife with Phil Clark
on ABC Radio.
Yes, thanks for joining us too. We're here on Nightlife. We're talking about AI and the future. My guests are Dr. Katrina Wallace and Stephen Sheila, both experts in AI. We were just talking with Katrina about how she built a robot to give talks like these. because after all, you can. How did it go?
It went really well. And what I realised when I would show Trinity or get Trinity to talk and answer questions, somebody said to me, "Hey, this robot is just like you." And I said, what do you mean? And they said, "It's just like you. It behaves like you. It speaks like you. Its tone is like you." And that's when I realised the programmer, and I don't code, but I designed it and I trained it with the data. We put something of ourselves in these machines. This was trained to be good and ethical and to speak well and to teach about ethics. Now, it was really a visceral moment for me where I went, holy shit, if I was a bad actor, I could also train this robot to act out and do very powerful things in the world in a very bad way.
There you go. Good. We've talked about, for example, interference in elections already. There's a huge danger posed by this, isn't there, of robots as actors in the democratic process, Stephen?
Yeah, I'm in some ways, I think we are boiling frogs right now in terms of how our information ecosystems have been impacted over the past 10 years or so. And it's the rise of the internet, the rise of social media have been accelerants of this. The world of disinformation, of echo chambers that people live within and don't get out of, false information that's out there, this idea that we're almost in a post-truth world. And we've kind of just been boiling away. And now we're going to add, the factor of AI on top of it. And, with deep fakes and with the ability to misrepresent or hyper-represent certain things to certain audiences in a very targeted way. And that is I don't think we can even predict the impacts and the outcomes that'll have on our ability to form opinions and to make decisions
to
as
mess
a
with
democratic
to mess
society.
With things. I mean, you could have our Prime Minister Anthony Albanese espousing views, for example, in a totally credible way that he doesn't have, because you could make the robot. You can make a robot that looks and sounds exactly like him, saying things whatever you want him to say.
Right.
And you put it on social media and it sits there for 2 weeks until it's somehow shut down, and then by that stage the damage is done.
And we're already struggling with being able. There's an idea that you can sort of watermark AI. But it's been shown that that's absolutely easy to get around and to eliminate. So it is a real fear, and it's hard to say how it's going to impact how we form opinions. But all I do know is that over the past 10 years or so, we have been boiled as frogs, and it's continuing every day, and it is a real challenge to how democracy functions and how we as a society form opinions and make decisions. And I know Katrina's been doing a lot more thinking about this in terms of areas like the metaverse as well.
We'll get to the metaverse in a moment. Just back on ownership, which I just wanted to finish that thread of discussion. It is owned by, this is the thing, it is owned by people. It's owned by essentially large tech companies.
It is. And it is owned by a handful of large tech companies. Run predominantly by males, and none of whom have showed any real orientation towards an ethical strategy, because that is not how tech companies are built. That is not how they're incentivized. That is not how engineers are instructed to behave. And so I think, and tech companies run the world now. It's not the banks that run the world. It is the tech companies. And we saw that, Phil, when the Ukraine-Russia war was, it's a very tragic thing that continues on, but was at a point where I think it was the US tech giant said, look, if this gets too bad, we'll just turn Russia off. We'll just shut down all of their tech, which could have happened.
Yeah.
Who rules the world? It's the tech giants.
Or turn off news in a country like Australia.
Yeah.
It's Facebook.
How real do you think that is? I mean, see, if you say that, you're essentially saying, because the other comfortable belief that people have, apart from the fact that AI doesn't really invent things, which is sort of, we've already discussed, it does.
Yes.
It does. So the argument about whether it's sentient or not is almost irrelevant because it probably is.
Well, let's just touch on that, right? So their consciousness, so this is really important. When people say, can their machines develop consciousness? Are they conscious? And if we think of consciousness being that is something is aware, that it's aware of its thoughts, feelings, surrounding, it can monitor, audit itself. The machines already can do those sorts of things. So when people go, it doesn't have empathy, it doesn't have feelings, doesn't have emotions, of course it doesn't. It's not human. The best way to think about AI, it's a new species and its consciousness will be different to human consciousness. So we'll continue to fail and underestimate these machines if we keep trying to humanoid or humanize them. They're not humans. They're a different species. They will have a different consciousness. So sentience, potentially in a different way to humans.
What do you think about that, Stephen?
Yeah, I think it's a great way of framing it. The moral or ethical compass that humans have is based on one thing, which is we live in societies where we have to nurture each other. We have to be cooperative, competitive with each other, right? So, you know, if we, sitting in this room, we all try to kill each other, eventually none of us are going to be alive because we'll all kill each other. So we don't do that. We follow rules. And those rules are beneficial to us, right? And I nurture my family, you nurture your family, then we send our kids to the same school, we pay taxes, you know, all these things are, and there's a lot of emotion that's tied up in all of that, which is around, you know, we care about each other as human beings. Now, machines aren't necessarily going to follow that path, right? Mm-hmm. They're not going to send their kids to school. They're not going to have kids. They're not going to propagate in the same way.
Exactly.
And so that emotional signature won't necessarily evolve within them the way it has within humans. They may have some emotions that somehow evolve, but there's no question that, you know, we are products of our evolution and our environment over thousands of years. And these machines won't have the same.
Could these machines care for us, Katrina?
Yes.
Could they could be written.
Well,
They could be written to care for us.
They can be written to care for us. They can be written to have ethics. They could probably be written to have morals. In a slightly different way to ours. The challenge comes with these machines that when they're instructed to complete or fulfill a task, that's
the task.
The task. And that will be done, ideally for them, at whatever cost.
Come hell or high water.
Come hell or high water. So that's the risk. And the other risk is that when AI starts to learn, so as we talked about machine learning, the machines start to conduct tasks and learn on their own accord. The engineers and we, the AI leaders, we don't know how they're learning. We don't know how they have created what they've created. It gets away from the original programmers. And that's the same even with generative AI and OpenAI's
program. Yeah.
They can't explain why it behaves
in
a certain way.
Can't explain the hallucinations are unexplainable by the people who've created
Tell
the
me
technology.
About the hallucinations.
So the hallucination in AI terms is, in simple terms, it says something that's not true.
Yeah.
We know this to be already the
case.
And it's simply...
I've won several Walkley Awards, for example.
Yeah.
Yes, and I've written many books that don't exist.
And you look at it and you say, well, how did it come to that conclusion? Well, even the programmers and the folks who produced
that, they don't know that.
They don't know how that happened.
Very basic understanding of hallucination is that the machines, like, go through you. Philip looked at, you know, in an instant, look at all your background, everything that's been published on you up until, you know, September 2022 or something. And then if they can't quite have confidence that they've got a quite the accurate answer because it's in their database, they will make representations. And so they will, so for me, they always come up with a new book title, you know, AI and the Destruction of Humanity or AI and the Super Algorithms.
It's almost like they don't want to displease you with saying, I don't know the answer.
They don't. And so they make representations. But they say it with such confidence.
Yeah.
And impressive. Like, I wish I'd written half the books that it says I have.
I wish I'd had the career that they've given me.
Exactly.
But that is a there may be a problem that gets resolved, but it is a it is a question which is, I feel untrustworthy towards the tools that I'm using today, in the sense that, not that I don't think they're really good, but it's, I find it's, you know, it's kind of, you know, kind of high school level delivery, right? It's pretty good, but I wouldn't put that student in charge of, you know, running a company or, you know, operating this complex machinery, right, or something. I'd say, no, they need more training. So they might get there, but there is this need today, at least with these the things like ChatGPT and Google's Gemini, you know, there is a real need to look at whatever they produce and say, hey, that's pretty good, but I'm going to have to take it a step further. And that's, you'll find that's how most people are using these tools today. They're using it to do 80% of the work, but then the final 20% still requires some human polishing. Now, even that 80% of the work is a big, you know, I mean, I for example, get, you know, ask questions about, you know, this or that, and I will turn to ChatGPT to often give me the first answer, and then I'll refine it. I'll add my own thoughts and knowledge to it. ChatGPT can't speak in my voice. It can't add my personal experience. Mm-hmm. I might have my own anecdote about something. I'll find that it's very sophomoric in its kind of expression. You know, for example, I said, you know, write me a 20-minute keynote on AI, for example. I just experienced, and it came up with something that was, you know, like a high school student would produce, right? It's not something I would stand
it's
on
okay.
stage.
It's okay, yeah.
Yeah, it was okay, but I'm not going to stand on stage and say this. Mm. So it was fine, and it was amazing it produced it so quickly, but you could quickly see the shortcomings. So there are a lot of shortcomings to AI, and the concern that I have at the moment is we are going to start to rely on it too much, or we're going to have folks who are not trained. I mean, the three of us in this room, and in fact, everybody listening to this program, you know, many of us have been through, you know, more classical education. We've learned to think, you know, in a rational way. We've learned maths and English and spelling and grammar.
Critical thinking.
But now when we start to rely on tools to do those things and AI, and we eliminate that base level of understanding, how do we know if the AI is making a mistake, if we actually can't check its homework.
How do we know whether it's telling us the truth? We don't.
We don't.
No. But in a sense, you raised the issue of critical thinking. When we read a book about the causes of the French Revolution, we don't know whether that's telling us the truth either. But we can apply critical thinking to suggest ways through that conundrum. We could do the same with this, couldn't we? Except you're saying we probably won't because we'll get exhausted. It'll exhaust us quickly.
It's also because we as humans, we're busy and we're lazy. We want a single answer, right? I just want the answer. And oftentimes that one answer is too simplistic or too reductive to be the real answer that actually is meaningful. And that is where human judgment and subtlety comes in. That's why you have a whole... If you want to look at the cause of the French Revolution, I'm sure there's 1,000 books that have been written on it, right? And there's not one book that was written by AI and you're done, or one Wikipedia entry and it's finished. No, it's it's a prism that you look at it from different angles, and depending on the angle you look at, depending on where you're standing in history, depending on your own experience, you may have a different answer to the same question, which could be equally valid.
So we talk about there needs to be a human in the loop. Mm. So ideally, we have these AI systems, they'll... do 60 to 80% of the work, there needs to be a human in the loop to apply that critical thinking or perhaps that creative thinking to get whatever is being
created.
Tell
me, where's that human? How does that work? Explain that.
Well, it could be anyone. So if it's there's a great example in the last couple of days with the government talking about AI for immigration.
They have been talking about that.
Yeah.
They've been talking about creating robots to determine all sorts of regulatory things that normally would be determined by regulations made by ministers.
Right.
They'll say, well, humans won't make those decisions anymore. Well, the robot will.
Correct.
Sounds like Robo did.
So is that a good idea? Is that not a good idea? So it is a good idea, I think, if there's a human in the loop. So... It's a good idea because the AI in many ways could get things a lot more accurate than humans can do because it's just more efficient, more logical. But when, as was reported in the news this week, when there are specific cases that do need a minister or a government officials thinking again about this particular case, we don't want the AI making decisions on that. So there should be a human for these critical things where humans are going to be hurt. There still needs to be a human in the loop.
A surgeon friend of mine, sorry, an anaesthetist friend of mine, who, of course, attends many surgeries, said, yeah, he said, I asked the other day, how would I anaesthetise a patient who'd suffered a knife wound in the neck, for example, which is something I'd unfortunately come across. It doesn't work in Australia, you'll be pleased to know, but in some parts of the world, this is a common enough injury. And he said, did give an answer, which was kind of okay, but I wouldn't do that.
Right.
But he said it was kind of okay,
right.
But I wouldn't do that. So this is the some at some point there's got to be what you're saying, there's a human overlay on this who would say, yeah. well
and this is
but Stephen, to that you're saying, yeah, but the trouble is this probably won't happen because people want the answer quickly.
When I kicked off the discussion, I talked about intelligence augmentation, IA, but that presupposes that the intelligence is the human in the loop, and what I'm worried about is that we're going to lose that talent, that skill to be able to be the intelligent human that can judge. What's that next level of judgment I need to have to say the AI is right or wrong, and here's the extra level of nuance I need to add? Because we still, as humans, need to have that intelligence to be able to make the right decision. And we may seek to replace so much of what we do just lazily or by simply not training people in our society to be able to make those judgments. So for example, I think one of the things we need to do in our education system now, right, starting from today, is to start to train our kids to work with AI.
Agree.
And to be able
profoundly
to
know, case, isn't it? Yeah. You can't hold this back.
And how and how you use it and how you don't use it, how it can be misused, what the right uses are, what the ethics and boundaries around it should be. All those things kids should be learning today in school. We shouldn't wait 10, 15 years before we get the curriculum right.
But do you reckon we can always spot it? Will we always be able to spot it?
Spot an AI produced?
Hmm. The answer is no, we won't.
No, we can't.
We can't now.
Currently.
We can't now. It'll get better.
I would posit another just a sort of a contiguous thought to that. And look, I'm big on AI. I run an AI company. I build AI with my business. I've got amazing people work for me that are building amazing tools. But I do think humans, we should have the right to live an AI-free life if we want. It's just, it's not exactly an analogy, but a few years ago, I'm old enough to remember when we were sitting in this room. You could be smoking, I could be smoking, I could be blowing my smoke your way. And it was perfectly legal. Now you can't do that. Secondhand smoke, I'm allowed.
We would all have been smoking it
exactly
a while back.
Now it's, I have a right not to inhale your smoke. I feel like we should also have the right not to inhale AI. And if I want to live my life, if I choose to have no AI in any products, services, anything I use, I should have the right to be able to quite easily turn it all off and just live an analog life. Move to Mullumbimby, of course.
Move to Mullumbimby. I wrote a paper a couple of years ago talking about the bifurcation of humans. So species need to bifurcate, which means split in two at some stage in their evolution, or they end up becoming extinct. So potentially the bifurcation can be exactly what Stephen's saying. It's the digital experiences. So those who, like me, can't wait to get a brain chip, wish I didn't have to have my phone in my hand, wish my phone was just in my ear. Or there might be other people, mostly coming from Mullumbimby, where I live half my time, and another place that Stephen loves, where they don't want any tech whatsoever. So the organic experiences. So bifurcation into digital experiences and organic experiences. And let's hope the two could live peacefully and not end up in
this is a, this is way. I mean, a lot of people believe this profoundly, don't they, that we are on the road to evolving into part machine, part organic material.
It's transhumanism. We are at the beginning of the era.
Some people
of
say we are already at that point in a way, if you look at the way people are behaving with their phones, for example.
Right, the phone is already a brain extension.
Yeah.
It's just the next step, which will be in the next 5, definitely 10 years, will be technologies like Stephen has expertise in, which is neurotech, where the technology is in our brains and acting in a way to help brain disease, brain injury. Already there is, like, Elon Musk's product Neuralink, which is a brain chip, the ability for people to think and whatever they're thinking to be written on a computer screen. That crude but successful brain-computer interface already exists.
Is it, Stephen, is it, given what we've discussed, I'm not trying to be gloomy about this at all, but when the internet arrived, you know, there were people saying, well, you've got to control this. But, I mean, attempts to control it or regulate it really have been spectacularly unsuccessful. Countries like China have made wholehearted attempts to do it, and they've probably been the most successful, and they haven't been successful at all. Not really. If you're trying to say, you know, can they stop the torrent of information that's available? Is it in a sense, because of its nature, beyond regulation?
And
people who talk about, well, we should be regulating this, I mean,
don't understand
what it is, or they wouldn't pose that question.
It's funny, you know, with the advent of AI over the past few years in the company I've been building, some mornings I wake up and I think we are nowhere near on top of controlling this new technology. And I use control in a very kind of cautious way, because I don't think, you know, controlling things that we don't even know what they are yet is probably not a recipe for success. But on the other hand, some mornings I wake up and I think, you know, we're controlling it too much. We're actually throwing so many legislative, regulatory ideas at something that really hasn't been fully developed yet. So even I get confused myself, and I spend a lot of time in this space about where we should land. But then I do look at the power of the tools that we're building in my company. We use AI to decode the human brain. My company's called Omniscient. We're sort of the open AI of the human brain. We build a large brain model, as it were. So, in fact, the size, the complexity of what's between your ears is more complex than everything on the internet is not nowhere near as complex as what's between your ears. That's how complex the brain is. And we've only had the AI tools in the past few years to be able to start to make sense of this. So my company, that's what we do, what we focus on. And even in that realm, I mean, that realm we think is going to be a big part of what happens in the 21st century is going to come out of the technology that we're building. But in that realm, you know, we're just scratching the surface of what we will really start to understand and enable in the next few years. And some of that is going to be extremely ethically challenging, and it's probably going to get ahead of regulation. As well-meaning as regulators are, it'll get ahead of regulation, or in fact...
But it's way ahead. We've only got one. The EU passed the AI Act recently in the last couple of weeks. It's the first significant risk-based legislation that can put some control over AI. The rest, there's nothing.
No. Well, look, we've had these arguments.
In the US, there won't be anything.
We've had these arguments over regulation of reproductive biology, for example, and quite frankly, regulators are just woefully behind the pace of what's available and what can be done.
But, you know, that letter you mentioned at the outset, I mean, I signed that letter, and not that I thought it was going to have... I actually thought, I didn't really think anybody's going to stop development. I thought that was an illusion. But I think there needed to be a statement made about, we do need to slow down a bit, because this technology, and there's people who are much more experienced than myself or Katrina in this area, even the fathers and mothers of this technology, and many of them will say, we're moving too fast, that there could be a very black future here.
But we're not going to slow down, are we? Because we're talking about five tech companies that own this, and they're not going to.
Unfortunately, I think you're right about that. Yeah, I don't think
so. My statement, Phil, is AI is good, and it will hurt people.
It's a new species.
Yeah, and I just was rewatching Oppenheimer on Netflix, and there's a lot of corollaries with atomic energy and the atomic bomb. I mean, good people, well-meaning people building a technology that's had a lot of good in the world, but it's also had a lot of bad.
Indeed. Look, it's been a fascinating conversation. It's been a pleasure to spend time with both of you. Dr. Katrina Wallace is the author of Checkmate Humanity, The How and Why of Responsible AI. Stephen Sheeler is CEO of Omniscient AI. We should get you back at some... Well, we should get you both back at some stage for more.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.